Telecast.
Hi, I'm Justin Crosby, and welcome to another Telecast. This week, we're back in La Rochelle on the French coast, the sunny side of the dock, where the international documentary community gathered. This week's show features a panel session I moderated for the event called The Octopus Strategy, and looks at how factual businesses are embracing the digital content revolution. The panellists are Sandrine Roustin, Managing Director of Belgian public service broadcaster RTBF's content division, Future Studios Chief Creative Officer John Farrer, Roxine Roos, co-founder of French audiovisual group Studio Fact, and Thomas Arbez, who leads content and creation at INA, the French National Audiovisual Institute, which is the repository of French radio and audiovisual archives. It's coming right up on this week's Telecast.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Mathieu Peugeot, Director of Strategy and Development at Sunnyside of the Dock. Welcome to this Octopus Strategy session, which is pretty much in line with the previous session on VR and television. We're looking at new business models. We're looking at new ways of storytelling as well. It's a bit of an intriguing title, maybe. You'll get an explanation of why we decided to use it. I love it, and you'll get some explanation later.
I'm Justin Crosby. I host and produce Telecast, the weekly global content industry podcast show. Please do give it a listen if you haven't already. I also run the Digital Content Forum, which takes place in London in November, and The Drop, which is a digital-first content industry website and newsletter, which you can sign up for free at dropmedia.co.uk. We're covering news about the business of digital-first content production distribution, and these are the many of the topics we're going to be talking about in today's session. Now, one of the key themes of this year's Sunnyside is the focus on audiences. And in this session, we're going to be discussing strategies to build, diversify, and broaden your audience. Plus, we'll be talking about how successful businesses in the digital first space monetize these audiences and how you can move your business to take advantage of the opportunities the various content platforms out there can offer you. So I'm joined by a brilliant panel who are at the cutting edge of social first production, distribution and monetization. So these are the guys that are leading and building successful next generation content businesses. So let's try and discover the secrets of that success. First of all, welcome to Sandrine. Sandrine Roustin is Managing Director of RTBF's content division. RTBF is a public service broadcaster delivering radio and television and multimedia services to the French-speaking community of Belgium. And actually, the title of this panel is taken from RTBF's name for their strategy, so thank you for that, Sandrine. John Farrer, next to me, is Chief Content Officer for Future Studios, one of the most viewed media groups in the UK, with over 120 million followers across a portfolio of successful social media channels and own channels, including Truly, a real-life story channel that has over 10 million subscribers on YouTube alone. As well as creating content and developing IP for social media channels, Future Studios also produces factual content for networks, including Channel 4, Netflix, Discovery, and ITVX. Next, we have Roxane Roas, a co-founder of Studio Fact, the first French audiovisual group to produce original content exclusively from True Stories. Studio Fact produces a wide variety of factual content spanning documentary, fiction, podcast, publishing, and the performing arts. And finally, last but not least, we have Thomas Arbez, who leads creation and content at INA, the French National Audiovisual Institute, the repository of French radio and audiovisual archives. INA has been a producer and co-producer of documentaries and original content for over 40 years, creating more than 2,000 documentaries. And they're now also becoming a leading digital leader in the direct-to-consumer space, creating multi-platform content across podcasts, social media content, and TV programming. Welcome, Thomas. Welcome, everybody. So, the Octopus Strategy, Sandrine. What do we mean by the Octopus Strategy? And tell us, first of all, about RTBF as an organization.
Nice to be with you. Hello, everyone. So, in 2016, RTBF has decided to change his organization and create three different platforms. We call that the platform. So we got the TV platforms with four channels, like linear channels. We got also 5 radio stations, like normal radio stations. And then at the center, we create 2 digital platforms. The first one is the platforms of every videos and audios content that we produce or we buy with exclusivities sometimes. And we also have rtbf.be, which is the platforms concerning the news and more, because we got sports, we got every type of thematics and topics, like, for example, environment, for example, democracy, and articles about all those things. So that means that we got in the same company the opportunity to publish on every type of platform. So we decided to change the organization. And because we are a group with everything inside, we decided to organize the RTBF with publics. So we don't produce for platforms, but for publics. And each publics got his own way to consume and to watch or to listen content. So we got 4 publics, which is the family one, which is the passionate one, the young adults one, and the kids and new generations one. And each publics has director or responsible who knows how this public is going to consume and to watch or to hear a content. And then a content is concerned, is considered as a universe, but not more as a slot, no more as a genre, but really as a universe. That means that when we got one content, brand, or we divided it in different universe and push it in different platforms. So this is very comfortable to work with this, because with one content, you can reach different publics with only one brand. It depends of the platforms you destinate the content, and it depends also of the public that you want to reach. So another point which is very important with this system is that we want interactivity. So that means that with one content, we never produce or buy a content only for one platform. It will be always, for example, with a podcast associated to the documentary, or with some short documentaries with a long one, or with game, because we also have a video games channels. So everything is possible like this. So I just want to be very clear, because sometimes it's not so easy as we try to reach every platform, every public. We are multi-content, we are multi-platform, we are multi-everything, which is not easy to understand. But I have here an example, which is one of our success, called The Nature Next Door. First of all, it was a magazine. But now it's more than a magazine. Now it's documentaries collections. It's also short documentaries collections on our digital platforms and also on the social networks. It is also podcasts and series of tutos. It is many, many different things. And it is also a QR code that we ask people to send us their videos on nature and nature next door in their garden, and then we collect those different videos and we try to make a show with. So it never ending.
So Sandrine, your businesses have been around for about 70 years, I believe, a very long-standing heritage broadcaster. So this sort of strategy is really cutting edge. First of all, what was the thinking that set you on this journey, and how has it changed the organization?
First of all, we have seen that the world is changing, to be honest, and that this is becoming the TV. For this reason, we need to use the interactivity, and we need to use the platform and what offers the digital technologies to us. So this is the reason why we develop Octopus strategy, and also because we know that TV audiences is going to decrease. So there is no choice. We need to reach peoples and audiences by other ways and by every ways we can. And engagement is, and what I call interactivity, is one of the way. For sure, in the organization, it has been a very long way, because I told you it was beginning in 2006 and we are in 2023. And we just now, I would say since 2021, we perform in this, and we got in the organization Fluidity, but it was very long and difficult. And it's also, it's again difficult, especially because the employees sometimes don't understand what we are going to do, what we're going to, are we going to lose our job? Because we have a production company inside with 400 people who works there. So they were very, very in difficulties with this changement. So we built an academy in RTBF and we got some a school, and everyone has to go there and everyone has to engage himself and form himself. Education is the key, I think. But yeah. Now when they see they can do images and audio in the same time, for example, they said, oh, this is a new world for me. So it could be a really a success. It's like a project of enterprise, of company.
John, coming to you, tell us about Future Studios, because I think many people will be aware of Barcroft Studios, which was the forerunner to Future. But tell us about the business, what you do, and you know how many people you've got in the business. Give us a sense of scale.
So Future Studios started life as Barcroft Studios. In 2019, Barcroft was bought by Future PLC. Future PLC is essentially 250 magazines, and I run the TV and video division. So we do everything from short-form documentaries for our AVOD channels. We program them on Snapchat, YouTube, Facebook. We then make video for our 250 magazines, which are kind of contextually relevant to the articles. And then we have a TV division that does about 30 hours of documentary every year. And I guess in terms of our Octopus strategy, the kind of the flywheel for us is to try and find ideas that speak to each one of those pillars. So it may be something that starts life as an article that we first produce as a digital series, and we then use that content to sell as TV. We also have a rights model where our AVOD channels are then turned into linear TV programs that we then sell to American cable broadcasters. So yeah, we're always trying to identify opportunities that can play across all of those different divisions.
It's really about getting that simple, strong story, that simple, strong IP at the center of this ecosystem, if you like.
Yeah, the way I look at it is that we essentially have three IP factories. So we have the magazines, you know, with all the amazing journalists that are writing articles day in, day out. Then we have our teams that are working in AVOD that are out in the world casting these extraordinary stories and characters. And then we have a traditional TV development team that are also looking for original IP and stories. So yeah, every bit of our business is focused around identifying really breakthrough IP.
And how's that content creation and distribution strategy developed over the years? Because there's one thing that we know about digital media, it's constantly changing. 2 years ago, TikTok wasn't barely spoken about. Now it's obviously one of the main short form channels out there. How have you adapted to that and built those opportunities for your content throughout all of those different channels?
Yeah, I guess our kind of superpower, if we have one, is we're able to listen to the audience and we're able to take real-time learnings, and we can see that because we're publishing a film pretty much every day. We can use that as almost like a listening device to find out what they're interested in, what they're staying with, what they're coming back to, and then that in turn can inform our linear strategy.
And Roxanne, you've got a very similar business, but also different at the same time to Future. Tell us about Studio Fact and what was the opportunity you saw when you co-founded your business?
Hello, everybody. So the group was created by Jacques Aragonès and myself. We met sometimes 13 years ago. We were working together in a Fremantle Media Group. I used to be the COO of this company, and Jacques was the manager of the press agency, which name is TV Press. And so that's the meeting of the entertainment and the journalism, in fact. And we decided that we had the opportunity to buy the press agency from RTL Group. And then we decided, and we had a long talk about what we used to like in life, what we knew to do, and what we wanted to do in the business context. And we say, okay, what we like to do is to tell true stories. And so we are storyteller. More than everything else, we are producers, and the DNA of the company is a high qualified journalist. We have some Albert Londres Prize winner over there. We are a war reporter over there. And so we have 35 people teams in the company, and one third of them are journalists. And we have 7 subsidiaries. And what we want to do and what we aim to do is telling all true stories in different ways. That means we have podcasts, scripted documentaries, live entertainments, and house publishing. And so as far as the IP's items are concerned, because from a fact, we have to take and to put an IP. So every fact are not able to be an IP. So we are sometimes taking a day from the podcast or from the house publisher. And we are trying to see what we can tell around this story.
And that extends into scripted as well, does it? Or are you purely unscripted?
No, scripted also. We just finished the shooting of our 2 first scripted programs, one for M6 and one for HBO, who is going to be in France in several months. So we have the first scripted program of HBO in France.
Right. Well, congratulations on that. There's a common theme running through some of the businesses here. It's interesting.
And last but not least, we have a partnership with Le Groupe Le Parisien Les Echos, which is very particular in France. So when we began to work with Jack, they were really interested in the fact that we have lots of journalists in the company and that the DNA of the company was journalism. And so they gave us the opportunity to have the exclusivity of the transformation of their content in audiovisual. And then after 1 year, they decided to come into the shareholder.
Thomas, coming to you, talk us through Ina, because you're another legacy business, if you like. Talk us through how the business has adapted to the new digital landscape and how and why your institution adopted an octopus strategy.
Hello, everybody. You probably know Ina, one of the biggest archive library in the world, collecting and preserving French TV and radio archives. Since its creation, Ina is also a producer and co-producer of documentaries and original content. But there was a big turn for us in 2006 when we launched ina.fr, our website. We became a digital media at this time. And so we became a digital media based on our archives, and we're now talking to the general public and the younger generations, which is totally new for us. And so now we are thinking our editorial projects based on this strategy, how we can talk to the general public and how we can use all our social networks.
So really, it's about you moving from a B2B business to a B2C business, and that's very different. And perhaps the direction of travel for a lot of producers, a lot of media businesses in the industry. Sandrine, coming to you. So for the producers in the audience then, who are looking to the future against the backdrop of particularly an unscripted at the moment, certainly the case in the UK, I get the feeling it is also internationally where we're looking at big squeeze in this business. There's less commissions. There's obviously a cost of living crisis, an ad revenue crisis, which is leading to less and less content being produced. Looking to the future then, how would you encourage factual producers to approach working with you as an entity going forward?
So with this octopus strategy, that means that we will never buy again one content only for one content. We have to buy the universe with the content. So that means that with one content, you have to come with severals, with podcasts, with videos, with why not Chronicon radios or different thinking. I think the next step, for example, would be the ebook for us. Then when you will go on our platform, your documentary, for example, will be in ebook. Then you will click and you can have the ebook in your own smartphone or tablet. So this is very important now to use also your rushes when you are in videos industry, the maximum way. This is the key, I think, to be efficient, because we know that and you know that with the same budget, you have to make more. So the only way is to think about your content as a universe and how you can use the maximum of your research, the maximum of your rushes, and the maximum of your work. You have to think it and to anticipate it since the beginning, because this is the only way to be efficient. If you think, for example, to interview someone for a TV documentary first, you have to think that this might be the conventional podcast of the series of the different interviews that you will have in the same documentary, for example. But you have many other ways to think about the fact that your content is not only for one specific platform, but for multiple and multi-platform.
So message to producers, don't just pitch you a doc, pitch the universe to you.
True. And the experience too, because as I said, we use and we need to engage the audiences. We need to reach them. And for that, we need interactivity. At RTBF, we use a lot of queer cut. And with the queer cut, you can have access to your program in a different way because, for example, for the public, they can download some videos, they can download also stories or maybe their comment on the content. And there is many, many ways to engage people, not only on social networks, but on the content itself.
John, tell us about your development process, because obviously to a producer, that means there's one development process for a documentary, but it could be very, very different when you're looking at that universe of IP. How has your production for digital platforms changed the way that you develop projects?
My background is in development, traditional TV development, and about 10 years ago, there was like the sizzle reel became a thing, right? We went from pitching ideas purely on paper, and then suddenly the buyers wanted a sizzle reel, whether that was a proof of concept or something that just gave you a real kind of flavor of what the show would be. And then we would sell lots of ideas off sizzle reels. And I think now the real challenge is almost like turning development into production. So make those developments live and breathe. So that might be like the question we always ask ourselves, whether it's an AVOD idea or a TV idea, is like, how do we own it? What have we got? What are the ingredients that we've got that make this undeniable for the buyer and also something that no one else can have? So we will now spend time and money on like tying down IP with contracts, you know, developing budgets and schedules, trying to kind of test the market with some of our, like, instead of doing sizzle reels, it's now, can we do a proof of concept that we can put on one of our YouTube channels to see a bit of feedback? And then when we're going into the buyer, we're taking this full kind of package of stuff. So not only the strategy, which is like, where could this idea live, but it's also something that feels like it already exists. And I think from a development point of view, that's the real key. It's when you're going into sell, it's like this thing already exists, and we're going to do it whether you're going to buy it from us or not. We're doing it anyway, and I think that is incredibly powerful. And I often describe it to my team as like, when we're selling an idea, we're bending the will of the universe to like what we want to do. Like all of these forces are saying, we're not going to buy it. We're not going to buy it. And we're going harder and harder. You are going to buy it. But it's by doing all of these things, putting all of these kind of points in place, that you give the best opportunity to sell an idea.
It's actually creating it before it's actually produced.
Yeah, you just summed that up in one sentence. And I spent about 5 minutes saying that, but it's exactly that. Yeah.
Roxanne, does that sound familiar to you? Is that how you're working?
Yes, but what I was listening from there also, because as I was saying, when we decide to develop a fact, because the fact is going to us, okay? And so we are just meeting all the people of the company and saying, okay, can you do something with that? Do you think there is a podcast for that? Do you want us to take an author to develop the program and maybe we can do something? Do you want to write the book with that? And we are just working. And the more there is potentiality of exploitation of the fact, the more the IP is going to come and the more we are happy with that. So we are making a like of a tree, sorry, with that kind of vision. We say, okay, if we are able to see this fact going everywhere in the wheel of the exploitation, that's the fact we want to develop.
So what does the next generation factual producer look like in terms of a traditional development and production team? What are the differences? For example, you, Joe, on your teams, do you have experts that are working on purely on audience engagement, for example, or data?
Yes and no. I think at the heart, the development team is the same. It's It's great storytellers, it's journalists, it's brilliant writers, it's people that can go out into the market and kind of, you know, identify, you know, new trends. On our social side, we do a lot of analysis around, you know, around the data, and that will feed into development. But at its heart, we're still looking for brilliant stories. And I think one of the, like, the elephants in the room here, right, is that my business now is quite big. So we have quite a lot of resource and we can invest in, like, so the example that I shared, you know, we invested in making that before we took it to the market, like a short form version. And I'm very cognizant that not everybody can do that. So, you know, it's the fewer, bigger, better. It's about really choosing and being really kind of strict with yourself in terms of, like, what have you got that is so unique and special? How does this thing get adapted? But then in terms of development, it's the same thing. It's like, what is a brilliant story? If you have that at the heart of everything, you can't really go wrong.
Sandrine, first of all, so producing lots of content across different platforms sounds really labor intensive. And you're now asking for a producer for more deliverables. And how can they afford to do that unless you're increasing the budgets?
So efficiency first, as I said, but for sure, it depends on the project. Sometimes you can rise the budget because we want more deliverable, as you said. So we have to change a little bit in our side, the structures of the budget. For example, at RTBF, we co-produce 70 documentaries per year, approximately, and we buy some others. It depends each year around 200 because we also have the platform of Your Doc Beard to broadcast documentaries. So we decided to produce less, I mean, to put money in less documentaries, for example, but with more deliverable. So that means that, for example, if we put, it's not exactly the figures, but if we used to put 10,000 euros for 60,000, for 60 documentaries, we will put 20 for 35. And then we will ask for more deliverable, more works on it. We think it's better. Also, it's a way to have, as you said, a big IP and stories we can travel everywhere. Because sometimes when we have some, I would say, small stories only for one platform, they cannot travel on others. So we prefer to put more money on a big story or a story that can reach two or three platforms different. It's better like that. So it's not going to be less budget for more deliverables. It's going to be, I would say, in moyenne.
Thomas, coming back to you, there's some projects we trailed earlier on that you've been working on that fits within this new digital landscape. Tell us about that one.
Yes, it's a project about Simone Veil. It is an old story because it all started in 2006. At that time, INA and the Fondation pour la Mémoire de la Shoah decided to collect the filmed testimonies of Holocaust survivors. So a very important project. More than 100 testimonies were collected by INA and are available on a dedicated website. Simone Veil was one of them, but she asks us to keep this testimony unpublished for the first time. That was her choice. And so we kept this testimony unpublished for 16 years. And last year, there was an opportunity because there was a release of Olivier Dahan's movie, Simone Veil, Légende du siècle. And so we thought it was a good timing to reveal this testimony to the public. So we went to ask Simone Veil's two sons, and we present our octopus strategy that we wanted to do around this testimony. And they said, okay. So we produced multi-format and several projects around this testimony. The first one is that we put the document in its entirety available on our website, like the others' testimonies. It's our mission, but the testimony is 5 hours long and you have to go to our website to find it. So the public is mainly historians, students and researchers. So we wanted to reach larger audiences. So we produced first podcast, which is called Simone Veil, Seul l'espoir apaise la douleur. in French. It's a 4-episode podcast. Each episode is 20 to 30 minutes long, so it's way shorter than the entire testimony. We chose to have a large distribution strategy. You can find the podcast on all distribution platforms, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, Radio France application, because we have a partnership between INA and Radio France, and of course, Deezer and Spotify. So that was the first editorial project. The second one was with a partner, which is Flammarion, and it's a book. So we co-published with Flammarion a book with the same title and same visual than the podcast, because they can respond to each other and complete each other. You have almost the entirety of the testimony on the book, and we are very honored because the preface has been signed by Simone Weil's sons. That's our second project. The third one with another partner, France Télévisions. We co-produced with France Télévisions in a news show called 13h15 le dimanche. Documentary, a 50-minute documentary based on the testimony and mixing with a lot of archives from World War II about the collect and the testimony itself. The last project is our own social media. So we created content from that testimony for Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The challenge was to find the right balance between relaying the other editorial projects, the book, the doc, etc., but never betray or reduce the testimony as a strength of the testimony, because social media are very short. And so it was a balance, but we did it, and I think we did a good job.
Well, congratulations. A challenge, real challenge as well, I imagine. Sandrine, how do you quantify success?
So this is the reach now that we calculate. OVO.bu is our platform, as I said, which is our art of now industry and business. So we accumulate the audience, the normal audience with TV, and the reach with our platform. This is one of the key of the success, but it's not the only one. As I am a service public, I also have the special panel of satisfaction, which is very important. And we don't only make it on TV, but also on radio, and also with OVO platform, and also with our rtbf.be, which is the articles and the publishing part of the RTBF. So there is a balance between audiences, reach, and satisfaction. This is the key of the way we calculate the success of and also the echo, I would say, which is quite important too. The echo that we can have on the social networks is quite also a part of the reach.
How about you, Roxanne?
Exactly the same, and maybe more the recommissioning of our program by the clients, because they are in front of the audience. We are producing lots of program, impact programs, so it's really important for us. Sometimes we are checking out what people are saying on the social medias. Of course, the broadcaster knows sometimes more than us, because we don't have the tools to know that. The fact is, sometimes we are checking what people are saying on the web. Sometimes it's a little bit frightening, but it means also that our program make people react.
Okay. And John, how about you? Because you gave an example earlier on. Presumably that's right at the top of the tree, something that goes eventually comes a scripted project, but also works well across all of those digital channels.
Yeah, I was going to be flippant and just say how much money we can make, but it's not just about that. No, I think it's the same as what my fellow panelists have said. It's really, we're measuring in reach. And I think with a lot of our projects now, we take the long view. We're not looking always for an instant return. And I guess, you know, rights retention is also a kind of a really key part of it. We make a lot of documentaries in the US where the rights, you know, you often work for hire. And so a big part of our strategy from AVOD into TV is to hold on to rights, and so we can then, you know, we have an expression of like make it once and kind of monetize it many, but we can only do that if we can retain the rights. So that's a key part of our strategy as well.
And Thomas, how about you? How do you quantify success for your projects?
we check the audiences. And so we were very happy for Simon Weiss because we had more than 400,000 listens for the podcast, and the book has sold 62,000 copies. So it's very important. And in an economic level, the money comes from the book. So that's with the book co-published with Flammarion that we can finance the podcast and all what we did. What's maybe more important for us is we are very proud to share this document and to try to reach different audiences and to try to build the memory of tomorrow, which is one of INA's missions. So maybe it's more important than the numbers.
Yeah, you're serving a wider public interest, so absolutely. Questions? Anybody got any questions here? There's a gentleman at the back there.
Hello, that was incredible. My name is Philippe D'Andrade. I'm a wildlife and natural history producer, and I have a production company called Comfort Theory. So we mostly work in Costa Rica, and so this is incredible, and I completely agree with everything you guys are saying. And it's funny because we produce natural history sequences and films for Netflix, Nat Geo in Costa Rica, but we didn't get the attention of the Costa Rican government until I launched National Geographic's TikTok from there. And then all of a sudden we started getting a lot of attention. So I completely agree with what you guys are saying. But my question is two parts. One, what is the advice that you would have from your side for creators? Because social media, number one, it needs to work quickly and it needs to work in the moment. And so the challenge with curating social media around productions is that it's always after the fact. But for the audience, they want to know what's happening while you're doing it. And so by the time the film comes out, revisiting projects from 3 years ago in the field and telling those stories, it loses its steam. And number two, how do you get networks to actually pay for it? Because they want these things, but they don't understand that it's native content that has to be curated on specific platforms. They just think social media is something you attach at the end of a project.
Yeah. Okay, Sandrine, I'm going to come to you first on that, as there was a mention of a...
Good luck with that answer.
Yeah, broadcaster there.
Okay, you ask for advices, right? I would say that in the future, I would recommend you to sell us as a broadcaster, the community that you have on the social networks with your content. Because this is the future, I think. I think that you have as a producer to make your own IP alone, I would say, on the social networks and then coming to see us with your community. And then I would buy a longer form, for example, or the resume, or maybe the backhand or whatever, about what you have done on the social networks. So this is the way I think the future is going to be for a producer. You have to produce for the social networks as a short. You have to think long and to come to see us with the long ideas and all what you can do with podcasts and whatever on, plus your community.
To the point on native content then that's being shot at the time of production, that has a value as well, doesn't it? That's really important that that's utilized and used, because there's all sorts of rushes and all other content that actually can be used not only the time of production but at the time of broadcast as well.
But I think it's very different, the grammar for TikTok or for a social networks and the grammar that you have for a broadcaster with TV linears or platform. It is very different. So for me, it's complementaire. Comment est-ce qu'on dit ça?
Complementary.
Easy. Yeah. Complementary. So.
I'm a natural.
Yeah, okay. This is the English way.
Didn't listen in fifth form at school at all, but, you know. Yeah. Thank you for that. Any other questions? Gentlemen there.
I'm Robin Barty King from Hard Cash Productions, a very linear producing investigative current affairs documentary company. Just wanted to ask you all, really, but I think, John, you picked up on a phrase right at the beginning. You said that you thought the cherry on the cake was the sale to HBO Max, which is a perfectly fair point. Do you ever think we'll actually get to a point whereby the social media income becomes the cherry on the cake?
I think it's an excellent question. I think certainly when I look at our slate, every idea has a slightly different cherry on the cake outcome. But what's important about the strategy is that for us, again, it's about retaining the rights. So what was exciting for us about the Marie Claire project, which was that if we'd have just developed it and then were lucky enough to sell it to a US network, we would have probably lost all those rights. But because of the way and the path in which we took it in terms of its development, that meant that we could not only sell it to HBO Max, but also retain the scripted rights as well. So that's why it was the kind of cherry on the cake for us. And so a lot of what we're doing is really thinking, how do we, in this very hard market where, you know, rights retention, particularly in the US, is very difficult, how do we give ourselves the best opportunity to hold on to those rights? Then, to answer your question, we keep evolving it. So maybe season two doesn't have to be for HBO Max. Maybe that exists on Marie Claire's platform and the audience is big enough there at that point that we become our own broadcaster as well. But for us as a publisher, that's a direction of travel, but I think we're probably 5, maybe 10 years away from that, all honestly.
I mean, you can't create social media content without the funding that goes with it for a linear film. Is that a reality?
Yeah, well, on our Truly channel, which is real life documentaries, there is a parallel with what you'd see on a kind of Channel 5 in terms of like an Extraordinary People or a Body Shop. We do a lot of medical. So there's real kind of correlation there. But the gentleman that asked the earlier question, what we found is that the audiences are quite different. So if we try and give the AVOD audience something that feels a bit too much like TV, they switch off. And if we try and give the TV audience something that feels a bit too much like AVOD, to your point, they switch off. So there is still this kind of delineation between what those two different audience watches. But what I think is really exciting from a business owner point of view is that those audiences don't always overlap. So you can absolutely serve them the same thing, but slightly different, and not worry about kind of cannibalizing your own audience.
And thank you, everybody. We're getting the red flashing light that our time is up now. Thank you very much to all of our panelists. Really illuminating, I think, conversation here. And we could have done another hour. We could talk about brand funding. We'd talk about all of these different areas that are developing. We've talked about what's next for your businesses and future business models. Maybe that's for next year. Please thank all the panel for their input. Thank you. Well, that's all from the sunny side of the dock. Next week, we're in Cannes for the Cannes Lions and finding out when or if advertising is coming back to TV. Telecast was edited by Ian Chambers and recorded in La Rochelle. Until next week, stay safe.